You are listening to The Dystopian Republic, and I, Raul Guerrero, am your host. We begin today's story on the morning of May 26th, 2000. Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, Camille, and 16 other students held packets while lining up outside their homeroom at Bramelby High School. Their teacher let them inside, told them to be seated with their project groups, and said that they'll get right into the presentations. He had Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille be first to present what they've spent their semester researching. The teacher expected something big from them, in particular as they completed the research project with an enthusiasm he's seen no other groups have. Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille walked to the front of the room with copies of their paper in hand and ignored whatever snickering gossip came their way. Camille thanked the teacher for having them go first, as it'll ensure their peers will be interested enough to take in what they have to say, promising to make it more than worth their while. Roth said he, she, Tiffany, and Giovanni decided to center their project on what they've uncovered about their respective biological parents. Camille called the story she and her friends were going to tell an end product of that research, assuring their classmates that it won't be anywhere near the bland gruel they think it's going to be. Tiffany said that once upon a time in North Bramel Beach, four young families lived in houseboats at the city's residential harbor. The date was November 11th, 1984, a day that started off overcast yet serene, and where nothing seemed off. Camille looked down and giggled at how her mother Ignacia filmed her walking down the pier and into her father Silvio's arms, trying hard not to tear up at that moment's utter adorableness. Roth was being held by his mother Sallow, who smiled at him while in the riveter uniform she wore to her job as a server for a fish and chips shack. His father Barnaby handed him his sailor hat, took him and his mom to their boat's cockpit, and let him pretend to drive. That played an old song that husband and wife called theirs, one about a beautiful riveter falling in love with a humble skipper her parents forbade her from dating. Barnaby loved how Roth was his little him, while Sallow couldn't wait to raise her son to have an open mind, be kind, and choose honor over advantage. The Sanchezes heard a knock on their door, and it was Puchel and Giovanna Villalobos who had their son Giovanni with them. Barnaby and Sallow could smell what their next door neighbors had been up to in the small hours, but the stench was more moist, stronger, and worse than ever. Puchel did all the catching as Giovanna held Giovanni to show him what a hard-working man looked like, their boat rocking like an amusement park ride. The Villalobos boat had springs that connected it to its bedrooms, allowing child and or parent to sleep soundly through each catch. Its blues were a shade wheel of ocean and night sky, waving and illuminating the pure water, dim clouds, and pruss blue robins. Hermit crabs and goldfish shared a closet that was stacked with tanks that separated but kept them close, emitting pretty hues and tolerably musty scents. The quarter both animals shared was also made jolt-proof by the springs that the bedrooms had to prevent spillage, cracks, and shifts out of place. 3 miles out at sea, the Barajas boat began its return to the shore after an hour of a radio show off the coast, vrooming as if its engine was taken from multiple race cars from the 60s. Its interior was that of a radio station's talk show room being jammed into an apartment like a soda can forced deep into a full trash can. Tiffany was instructed by her mother, Mariana, and father, Bradley, to say goodbye to the millions listening, which she did with a voice as adorable as a kitten's face. Neither parent was aware that their show never went live, trapping them in ignorance of what Gregorio Jr. recently declared. Nearing the shore, Mariana watched Camille play patty cakes with the other girls, and Bradley chuckled seeing Roth and Giovanni playfully wrestle. Tiffany smiled, tried to free herself from her mother's grasp, whining and crying when she couldn't. Bradley and Mariana pleaded with their sweet baby to shush while gently rocking her, then let her stand by herself, making her want to join the girls even more. Shortly after the Barajas boat was docked, Tiffany suddenly no longer wanted to step out and hugged her parents tight as fear overwhelmed her. Teenage boys and girls held the hands of or carried their younger counterparts as they hasted to the pier with faces as chilled in color as the marrow in their bones. They beseeched everyone there to take to the seas and help them do so while escape was still possible with unexcelled hysteria. Most couldn't figure out why the kids wanted to evacuate Bromelia because last time they checked, Habsburgo defeated Gregorio in a landslide. An overnight election party was held in a rec center in Belos town, Las Grandes Cascadas, where the young could dance, take pictures, snack, smoke, drink, and josh to a victory that surprised few. That fun mood disintegrated when the grisly cloud that was the initial massacres bared down on the venue at the same time it enveloped Bromelia. What came exploding in moments later led the houseboaters who attended the party to be at the pier before their neighbors, having escaped an annihilating cavalcade that seemed endless. The cries, screams, gunfire, and explosions from downtown North Bromel Beach slowly approached the harbor like smoke rising out of a fire. Mobs of panicking residents rushed toward the harbor as the chaos got closer more quickly, making Ignacia and Silvio scoop up Camille and hustle Salo, Barnaby, Bushell, Giovanna, Mariana, and Bradley into getting in the boat with Roth, Giovanni, and Tiffany in tow. Helicopters with speakers attached to them told the people running away that they're racing to a salvation that doesn't exist. They then warned the runners that consequences of a lethal quality will befall like the steady rain on those who take to the seas, and called that warning the last one they'll receive. Ignacia yelled for the helicopters to F off and die, then Silvio started the boat and sped off like a drag racing car off the start line. The Barajas boat was the fleeing example. Other houseboats followed as Yellow Cross troops raided the harbor on foot, in vehicles, and by the air. Most were rounded up like cattle, and the few who resisted were shot and beaten into submission or death. Thinking that their raid was a success, Yellow Cross troops loudly let their anger be known when they saw all the houseboats speeding away from them faster than cars on a freeway. Informed of the desperate race, Etchelstone dispatched amphibious units near the harbor to chase down the absconders. The Sanchez's, Barajas's, Villalobos's, and Gomez's were just under a mile into the run for salvation when the extent of their life change hit them. Giovanna felt so guilty leaving the crabs and goldfish behind, as did Bushell, but he told her that the fates of their pets were now God's to determine. Ignacia tightened her hug of Camille and was still unable to believe that her life in Serenity was over, watching Silvio drive with trembling eyes that told him to go faster. Bradley and Mariana screwed each other's emotional pangs away in the bathroom as Tiffany, Roth, and Giovanni fearfully hid in an empty closet. Ignacia stepped outside to see if there were any yellow crossers after her, but breathed a little easier when all she saw were houseboats following her or letting Silvio follow them. That made her hopeful that she, her husband, and all whom they've taken will soon be free and have the United States be their oyster. Spaceship-like submarine boats shot out of an abandoned Coast Guard yard at the western end of North Bermel Beach's coastline like bullets, and were now in hot pursuit with Allred Jr. leading them. Salo, Mariana, and Giovanna sat with Ignacia, relishing how their new life in the United States won't be all that different. To them, it seemed that all the houseboaters were able to escape the harbor before the Yellow Crossers took it over. While all the houseboats made it out uncaptured, that didn't necessarily mean the people who owned them did. The head start the houseboaters got from the Yellow Crossers mattered less and less the further both parties were from the harbor. Allred salivated at how rapidly he and his boats were closing in on the houseboats, telling his inferiors that it's time the absconders be shown that when it comes to the Yellow Cross, nowhere is safe, or indefinitely so. Barnaby opened up a large chest full of automatic ammunition and handed Bushell bullets for him to put into numerous assault rifles. Bradley used a CB radio to contact a houseboat bringing up the rear and was merry to hear that all was symphonic, a good feeling broken by the squeakiest and most shivered up OMG he ever heard. What followed was an approaching, over-revving roar and screams cut off by gunfire that hit the boat he communicated with like missiles. Allred took joy in seeing the houseboats, his units, targeted, and their occupants in pieces, floating dead or doing so fatally injured, seeing to it that survivors with a chance to survive had that hope shot away. As Silvio kept on driving, Bradley ran outside, joining Salo, Mariana, Giovanna, and Ignacia in bearing witness to an unfolding horror. One by one, or by larger numbers, the houseboats and their occupants were being shot to pieces with bullets powerful enough to shoot into vessels and out them like sheets of notebook paper. And if seeing the Barajas boat and the people who took it getting blown up wasn't bad enough, Giovanna had to see fish fins and crab claws hit her cheeks. That broke her down such that Ignacia and Salo had to toughen up and be her arms to cry into, but Mariana and Bradley hustled them and themselves back inside before any relief could be felt. Allred gave attaboys and girls to his units for taking the absconders out with flawless efficiency, telling them to keep the carnage coming. His attack's second wave was as perfect as the first, putting him and his units within striking distance of the Gomez boat and leaving behind a destruction even the youngest and cutest weren't immune from. Ulred glanced at the floating or sinking dismemberment and obliteration without so much as a tearful wince or dimming smile. He applauded his units for their excellent work and promised that he'll see to it that Ulred Sr. spoils them rotten later. In his rear view mirror, Silvio caught the houseboats right in back of him being obliterated, dismembering their occupants, and splattering them all over the back of his boat. Ulred Jr. saw that he was down to the very front of the absconding entourage, saying it's time he cut their hopeless dart for salvation short. He was tempted to praise the remaining houseboats for having the stomach to keep running even after seeing what he did to their brethren and sistren. Loaded rifles in hand, Barnaby and Bushell charged outside in spite of Giovanna, Sallow, Mariana, and Bradley's hysterical pleas for them not to. Ulred noticed that the Gomez boat looked different, but said it didn't matter, for he'll shoot it off the face of the earth like he did to the others. He then heard what sounded like rocks hitting his boat at the speed of sound and caught Barnaby and Bushell shooting at him and his units, finding it pathetic and somewhat annoying. Ulred told them their pebbles were useless against his perfectly alloyed boats, getting Silvio and Ignacia to say they'll show him what alloys can really do. When Barnaby and Bushell had no more bullets to fire, they realized that almost no damage was dealt. Their shock and feeling that they failed was humorous to Ulred, saying that it's his turn to go on the offensive as he and his units aimed, locked, and fired. Every boat but the one Silvio and Ignacia owned was shot to nothing, taking its people with it and reddening the water with their blood and guts. That made the Sanchez's, Barajas's, Villalobos's, and Gomez's discover that they were the only houseboaters left. Ulred repeated that discovery to them and said that since there, all that remained of their little community, he'd be willing to spare them if they surrendered. Sallow yelled that over her or her friends' dead bodies will they ever, ever submit to him, knowing he'll do away with Barnaby and Bushell for their shooting. Silvio called that offer worthless because he believed that by now the Gomez boat was close to crossing out of Bromelian waters and into those owned by no one. One check and total zoom out of the radar were all Ulred needed to figure out what the people in the Gomez boat were trying to do, and it jammed his mind into panic mode. He screamed for his units to stop that houseboat, for they mustn't get past the 14-mile markers or they'll be the world's to take and interrogate. Ulred threatened to have his inferiors beaten raw if the absconders crossed into international waters alive, scaring them into unleashing an all-out assault that was cosmetically effective. That had him and them at a loss for words, expecting the Gomez boat to suffer the same grisly fate as the other houseboats. Ulred had his units repeat the assault and do so a third time, but only cosmetic damage was dealt in both instances. He had an inferior take the wheel while he looked at the boat more closely and saw wood and metal mesh like sodium and chloride, leaving him speechless. In enraged shock, Ulred advised his units that their foes weren't merely stubborn, but had an alloy like no other to defend them. He identified the wood metal mesh as a sheet metal that's impervious to bullets of all calibers and highly resilient to to explosions such as those from grenades, rockets, and even missiles. Allred called that bad since neither he nor his unit had any explosive weaponry on them, punched the wall and yelled out three deafening Fs. After calming down a bit, he added that the mesh was known as Red Woxton, an alloy of redwood and tungsten that Alexis Jr. patented in the late 1940s to manufacture vehicles and vessels that could withstand a long-term war and large-scale bombardment. Allred said it failed since it was too heavy for most cars and boats, and making them able to carry that weight caused them to drink gasoline like fish. Red Woxton wound up seeing its use be limited to buildings, but it appeared to him that Alexis or someone close to him found a way to make the alloy light enough for houseboats such as the Gomez boat. Regardless, Allred was livid since all he and his units could do was collide with their target until it's on its side or roof. He then realized that the boat's body may be all but impenetrable, but that didn't mean its windows or occupants were, ordering his units to ram the houseboat and shoot through the glass. Silvio set the Gomez boat on autopilot, anticipating the speed up and charge at like it came from far away. Just over a mile past a 14-mile marker, naval ships from the United States performed routine patrols of international waters northeast of Bromelia. The people in or on them were unaware of Gregorio's rise to power or the chase rushing their way, but after hearing a crash, they knew that something wasn't good. American ships established a defensive line half a mile in front of the marker, staring at the pursuit when it entered their view. The Gomez boat fishtailed until it could regain its traction and push straight ahead, as the damage it sustained was still strictly cosmetic. In fact, the windows were only cracked up like frost coating a windshield, making Allred beg God not to effing tell him that the glass was alloyed too. That's when he saw the line of naval ships from afar spooking and angering him into telling his inferiors to halt, turn back, and rush for the harbor, because the absconders now belonged to the Americans. The second Allred and his units sped south, the Sanchez's, Barajas's, Villalobos's, and Gomez's knew that they made it. The Gomez boat rushed for the line like a young girl running to her father's arms, smiling as they surrendered and were taken into custody. Camille said she'd be lying if the four families lived happily ever after, because she, Roth, Tiffany, and Giovanni don't know what happened to them afterwards. The teacher voiced his condolences, thanked them for their presentation as his other classmates were left with nothing to say and could only clap in awe. He wasn't too bothered by the less than passionate clapping, expecting that after what spread throughout Bromelby recently. The teacher had no concern for those affected, since he was confident that the effects were temporary, as he too was sickened and now recovering well. In any case, he'd like to see Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille after class to discuss their project further in private. The other four groups struggled to present their projects, as their members were more heavily impacted by the unknown substance found in Bromelby's water supply. No one knew how the contaminant got into the water, but many suspected that it was put there intentionally, but there was no evidence to confirm that as of yet. But for people like the teacher, Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille, the substance made them no less sick than they'd be after consuming bad fish. When the bell rang, everyone but the mentioned five happily staggered out for recess, using those minutes to urinate, defecate, or vomit in the bathrooms, which had lines that partly crossed the yard. The teacher looked over the project Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille produced, raised an eyebrow, and had a number of questions to ask them. He noticed that the works cited in their bibliography contained the phrase "identity withheld," wondering why they thought that was necessary. Roth said the people who provided the materials wouldn't have done so had they not been promised that who they were would remain unknown to the world. The teacher understood that there were instances where withholding people's identities was okay if it meant getting the truth out. But what's keeping his eyebrow raised was why that was needed for a project about family origins, confusing the four and having him say that they now see what he meant and that it's unusual in his opinion. Since Roth, Tiffany, and Giovanni were pondering, Camille answered that revealing the authors of the works they cited may result in trouble. The teacher pushed her to elaborate on the problems that could arise, and that flustered her as much as it did her friends. On the fly, Tiffany said there's certain things that only she, Camille, Roth, and Giovanni should know about or discuss amongst themselves. What she said briefly pushed the teacher back, but he reverted to saying that the project was inevitably going to reveal some personal stuff. Camille called that true, but said that had limits. She and her peers get to dictate and not him, baffling him in that the whole class swore in writing to keep what was revealed within the homeroom's confines. The sworn statement declared that oath to secrecy under penalty of expulsion, ensuring that the information revealed can't be used for harassment. The teacher said there was no reason for Camille or her friends to withhold any identities unless doing so risked outing some less than honest conduct. He knew about the trouble those four got into in middle school and said their permanent records were as rich in content as in encyclopedia. The teacher said it was miraculous that Camille and her friends will graduate with honors given how they're regulars at the principal's office. Tiffany told him that he's being an unprofessional jerk and to get off her and her friends' buttholes. The teacher reacted by saying she's now being absurd and ridiculous, spelling out how suspicious he is of her and her friends, and that he's not far from having them investigated. Tiffany found it cute that he's now threatening her, Roth, Giovanni, and Camille, advising him to watch what he says as his next word could cost him his career. The teacher put his hands up and said the four have won, apologizing for being so accusatory and making up for it by telling them ahead of time that their project will receive an A-minus grade. That made Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille ecstatic enough to accept his apology and implore him to join them in forgetting that this talk ever happened. The teacher told the four to consider that done, told them that they may now leave, and wished them the best of luck at Bromelby University and with life in general. After they left, he told Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille that they're going to need all the fortunes they can get, for he's not done with them by any means. The teacher said that while now wasn't the time to strike, he was sure that moment will come before too long. He called Demi and made sure Cadence was with her before they can have a chat as father and daughters, identifying himself as Leonard Brell. Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille chilled and talked small without any clue of what fate had in store for them. Leonard voluntarily resigned the following week after a former student accused him of having an illegal relationship with her. He ended up having to settle for a job as Camp Moonset's new camp director and thought his life will never be greater than mediocre. But on August 18th, 2001, Dean Jr. showed his minions the photos the security guard took, and within minutes, he got a response. Leonard called him to identify the four as Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille, former students of his with a lot more things to hide than the rocket attack itself. He made copies of their permanent records well before his former principal had him pack his stuff, and so the dirt he had on them was gargantuan. Leonard asked Dean if the plan at Camp Moonset was still a go, and smiled when his superior said that it'll be put into motion no matter what. Some at Bramelby University wondered if finishing the orientation like normal would be respectful to the fallen, but most others believed that doing so was the better thing to do, as it'll show the rocket attackers that the university won't live in fear now or ever. Those reluctant to continue the orientation then realized that relenting would take them to a place far away from campus. That convinced them to join their non-reluctant peers, but only because they'd do anything to get away from any further danger. And on the sunrise of August 20th, Bramelby University's orientees and resident assistants were en route to Camp Moonset by bus, hovering from excitement to grief and back. On the back row, Giovanni was sleeping, Camille ate a nutrition bar, Tiffany wrote in her journal, and Roth guiltily looked out the window. Winston and Ursella weren't in the bus, as they were still in the hospital, but were now conscious, alert, and thankful to be alive. Bo and Floor were released the night before for when sleep to properly prepare for the retreat, and relied on coffee and tea to stay awake. They were full of a sorrow that wished Winston and Ursella were with them, touching Roth and even Tiffany to a degree, but got nothing out of Camille, Giovanni, Demi, or Cadence. Bo and Floor rested on one another, not to get some sleep, but to feel the other's warmth in hopes of bringing light to their dim moods. That was loudly jolted to an end by the bus blowing a tire out of nowhere, making it limp a quarter mile to a humble gas station tire service in Bowner. The driver let Leonard know of and apologized for his situation, receiving a tell to not fret, for his payload will be on time by hook or by crook. Shortly after, numerous cars with Camp Moonset emblems flooded the gas station, and their drivers identified themselves with employee IDs. Orientees and resident assistants piled inside with an even greater determination to finish the orientation. Bo and Floor were in a woman's coupe with Demi and Cadence, while a man had Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, Camille, and two others in his three-row SUV. From station to camp, the drivers had to hear the worries orientees and resident assistants had about their belongings still being on the bus. They suppressed those concerns by assuring them that they'll be reunited with their stuff and thanked them for it very soon. The drivers elaborated that when the bus arrives at camp, all fixed up, the belongings that orientees and resident assistants cared so much about will come also. Most believed those words, but some were beginning to feel that there was more to them than meets the eye. Dressed ready for business, Barbara was in the middle of some paperwork in her office at the center of her supercenter's core. Leonard called to inform her that all was well and asked how things were going on her end with a breathy, sinister chuckle she liked a lot. Barbara said she's got BS2 establishing a perimeter around her supercenter's pharmacy now that an open-air mass grave has been made out of it. Leonard whispered a holy S at the good she's made on her promise to make Bromelia scream in pain, charming her into thanking him for identifying the rats who masterminded the rocket attack. He had a tall stack of newspapers in his office detailing the misery that spread like a virus throughout Delgadopolis. Leonard found the tears shed from the writers pitiful, but never doubted their sincerity, for he'd be sad too if he was still teaching in Bromelby. Barbara laughed, assumed he was kidding, and yelled that if those democratic hornets were upset now, then they've seen nothing yet. Staring at a flyer of Bromelby University's Study in Bromelia program, she prodded and sensually ran her fingers on it. Barbara felt so heavenly knowing that there will never not be any new people to force into her ranks, and said that Rounce the First and his liberal gang have no idea what they're really in for. She knew Bromelby University made the study abroad program possible by partnering with the University of Bromelia at Delgadopolis. Barbara wanted to break the standoff, but Dean thought it was better to drag it on until his reinforcements can surprise BS2 from behind, pleading with her to wait a couple days more. She relented and told him that his backup better come or the supercenter will eventually be lost, putting them and their comrades in danger. Barbara gave Leonard the okay to settle his score with his former students, but warned him not to let that distract him from getting Bo and Floor. Asked about Winston and Ursella, she told him not to fret because she's got other subordinates who'll deal with them the second they leave the hospital. Sophia was standing in her apartment's patio of a yard, looking up at the sky and breathing in the minty, warm breeze when her home phone rang. She asked Leonard if her plan for Camp Moonset was moving without trouble and was glad when he said yes. Sophia found it so amusing that Dean, Barbara, Demi, and Cadence think he's on their side when he's actually working for her, telling him to do the job she assigned him at once. Leonard had hung up on Barbara before calling his real master in the insulated privacy of his camp director's office with a jokester's smile. His forgiveness of Dean for abandoning Allred Jr. nearly a year earlier was a front to get back at him later, feeling confident that Sophia will give him the closure he'd kill and torture to have. Leonard walked into a single restroom and took off half of his multi-layered uniform to reveal a back that's been scribbled all over by a whip's lashes. He said it served him and his fellow associate captains right for failing Alured and made it his mission to avenge, reobtain, and someday be the one ruling the global order. Leonard put back on the clothes he removed to stare at his scars, exiting the office and walking to the camp's center stage amphitheater like a god. He stepped onto the stage and let his presence inspire his diverse staff, every one of whom looked at him as if he was all they had to live for. Leonard thanked his underlings for showing up in sickness or health, as both conditions will help him serve their guests well. He was going to inwardly say sorry to Demi and Cadence for what he's about to do, but remembered that he's been estranged from them since his resignation. In his possession was a weapon neither Dean nor Sophia knew about, and it was under the office, ticking like a beating heart in wait for his command to fulfill its purpose. Sophia texted Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille something she learned about Roth that made their blood boil and them think he's going to play them false. Leonard sensed the parade of cars he sent to pick up his guests closing in on his camp, eye closing his sigh that at long, long last he'll get every single thing he wants served on a silver platter. He looked at his fists as if Sophia and Dean were his left and right, respectively, believing that they were puppets whose strings he pulled. Leonard led his followers to the camp's main parking lot like a black sheep directing his white opposites, having them join him in watching their cars arrive, park, and have their occupants step out. Demi and Cadence froze when they saw Leonard as if he was a ghost, having seen how bitter he was about their estrangement all over his Prysip page. And when Roth, Tiffany, Giovanni, and Camille discerned him, they were equally surprised, viewing him as the last person they could see running anything after that forbidden fruit he wolfed down. Running out of patience, Barbara considered bucking Dean's order to wait, wanting to display her own formidability. She craved the pleasure of adding to the grisly pile she's already made sizable, setting her eyes on her leader's chairmanship. And as fate would have it, the camp and supercenter situations will collide in a pileup no one expected. And that was the Houseboaters. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.